the major party vice presidential candidates. Democratic Senator Kamala Harris and Republican Vice President Mike Pence squared off in their only debate that they'll have ahead of the election. For an hour and a half, the candidates argued over the future of taxes, climate change and jobs tied to fracking, and racial bias in law enforcement. Throughout the debate, the COVID-19 pandemic took center stage as both candidates criticized the other side for lacking a substantial plan to deal with the crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What were some of your takeaways from last night's vice presidential debate? Do these debates matter to you? Who do you think won if you call winners on these? Do you want to see more presidential debates? Some of those are up in the air right now. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Andra Gillespie is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute at Emory University. Andra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what are some of your basic takeaways from last night's debate, Andra?
Each of the candidates had two challenges, so they were very distinct. Because he is the incumbent, Vice President Pence didn't have to prove that he could take over for President Trump in the same way that Senator Harris had to. So, the stakes were high for her. If she made a major misstep or a major gaffe, it could actually help diminish confidence in the overall ticket and call into question Joe Biden's judgment. I think on that regard, she performed well. I think people can tell that she was ready and prepared and that, you know, she needed to take over, that she could be ready on day one. Vice President Pence had to defend the Trump record. And in particular, he had to defend it after a week of really bad news. The first, President Trump's horrible debate performance last week, and then the COVID diagnosis. So he was on the defensive, and he did, you know, provide a defense of the Trump administration that would likely appeal to his base. But I don't know that if he was able to convince other people who have been really dissatisfied with what they've seen from the Trump administration, particularly in the last week.
Yeah, big picture. It seems like something really big or weird would have to happen in a running mate debate to really move the needle on the election, right? It's kind of uncommon that this is going to be a debate that really swings things one way or another. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, so in general, vice presidential candidates aren't the draw to the ticket. So people vote on who the presidential nominee is and not who the vice presidential nominee is. I think the stakes were higher this year because both of the vice presidential nominees are younger than their running mates, and these running mates are the oldest candidates in history. So, there is some concern about that, and the concern about whether or not they would need to take over. And in that respect, they might actually be influential on the overall vote in ways that vice presidential candidates historically are not. But at the end of the day, people are voting for Joe Biden and Donald Trump. They're not really voting for Kamala Harris and Mike Pence.
And this debate happened in the midst of not just COVID-19, but in the midst of this White House outbreak that seems to be getting wider and wider. Did that change the tone or the feel of the debate? I mean, apart from, I guess, the plexiglass?
Aside from the plexiglass, I think it was those first set of questions, particularly when Vice President Pence didn't really respond to the question that about why America has had a disproportionate number of cases and a disproportionate number of deaths. His supporters will likely not be deterred by the answer that he gave. But I think for a lot of people who are planning on voting for Joe Biden, there was nothing in that answer that was particularly comforting. In fact, it just looks really evasive.
I want to give a listen to both candidates talking about COVID-19 a little bit. Let's start with the challenger, Senator Harris.
They knew what was happening and they didn't tell you. Can you imagine if you knew on January 28th as opposed to March 13th? What they knew, what you might have done to prepare.
And then here's a listen to Vice President Pence.
The reality is, when you look at the Biden plan, it reads an awful lot like what President Trump and I and our task force have been doing every step of the way. I mean, quite frankly, when I look at their plan that talks about advancing testing, creating new PPE, developing a vaccine, it looks a little bit like plagiarism, which is something Joe Biden knows a little bit about.
So this COVID-19 outbreak, a huge issue, of course, for the country. Polling suggests that people don't favor President Trump on the COVID-19 issue. Do you think either side made a compelling case? You were starting to touch on this already, Andra, one way or the other on COVID-19 here.
What I'm not sure about, and we have to see it, is for people who are undecided whether or not the arguments last night actually swayed them. I don't think that they will actually be particularly persuasive in that particular regard for people who haven't quite made up their minds yet about who they're going to vote for or what they think about the COVID response. At the end of the day, I think that both of the nominees did what they were supposed to do in supporting their partner. At the end of the day, we're going to come back and vote for the people who are at the top of the ticket, not the people who are on stage last night.
We were talking about debates, last night's vice presidential candidate debate in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions and your questions. Andra Gillespie is with us from Emory University. Let's go to a caller now. Marcia is with us in Madison. Marcia, hi.
Hi. I watched last night, and then we had watched the previous one with Biden-Trump, and so frustrating that we didn't watch it all. And then they talked about the next day taking care of, respecting each other's time and it was just terrible. So anyway, I don't know why they can't get one moderator who can handle both of them. Two, why aren't they turning off speakers of the one who just continues to talk? It's getting to the point where I don't want to watch it, listen to it anymore, watch it, whatever. I mean, it's just, what is the, solution there? There is no, respect anymore.
Marcia, thanks a lot for the call. Andra, Marcia saying it looks like debate rules were made to be broken, and she'd like to see something done about that.
I understand her frustration. I think that there are a couple of things that are at play. First, it's actually a time-honored strategy in political debates for candidates to attempt to try to run over time to try to get that last spot in. There are some people who have made the argument, I don't know if I agree with it, that it shows that you have so many ideas that you can't get it all in the minute or the 2 minutes that you're allotted. So I wasn't surprised that people ran over time. I mean, I think we should note that neither Pence nor Harris, broke the rules in the same egregious way that we saw it happen last week. And even with the interruptions, and there were interruptions, there weren't nearly the number of interruptions that we saw in the first presidential debate. I think that the subject of whether or not the moderator should cut off the mic is a touchy subject, right? Because especially when you're dealing with incumbents, we're cutting off the mic of the president or the vice president of the United States. And so somebody needs to be able to do it. And you would hope that somebody who's in a position of leadership also knows how to follow and to be respectful of rules and to model good citizenship in that way. It's actually really hard to do when you're actually in the situation. So in some ways, I would actually, not having moderated a political debate before, but having moderated many forums in my administrative role as director of JWJI, I know that when a speaker wants to talk, really it's hard to stop them. Even when you're gesturing and doing everything to kind of shut them up. So you have to come up with other ways to try to finesse it, which is why I think you heard Susan Page saying, thank you, Mr. Vice President, a lot in an attempt to very suddenly tell him to shut up. And he just would not take the, he wasn't going to take the bait.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Lodi. John, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to share my thoughts on last night. I'm a moderate that by very slim margin voted for Trump last time around. And I'm just having trouble again this time making up my mind because I just can't believe that the Democrats, which I've always voted prior to this last election, can't put together a ticket. I'm just very surprised at it. I think Kamala Harris is not the least bit qualified and Joe's on his way out. So. It's unfortunate. I think she got killed last night.
John, thanks for the call. He didn't support Senator Harris's performance last night. I think she's unqualified, Andra.
Well, I mean, I respect his decision. I mean, I think a lot of it was just stating opinion. If we look at the ways that Senator Harris could be considered qualified for the job, and most of the time we look at that based on prior experience, she certainly has held the requisite jobs that would tend to qualify somebody for being president or vice president of the United States. Historically, we've often looked at senators and governors, the fact that she's a sitting senator, the fact that she's an attorney general of a state, the fact that she's been a prosecutor, the fact that she's held elective office before. you know, some people would look at as a qualification. I understand why some people disagree, or why some people may disagree with her policies and the things that she's championed in those positions. And I think in terms of the debate, one, I wait to see the scientific polls that come out that will say sort of who won that particular debate. But I think it's also important to go back, and I would encourage, you know, all of your listeners to go back and not just listen to the substance of the comments about what they say, but to also screen everything through the fact checker, because, you know, both candidates said things that were misleading. Some candidates said things that were outright untruthful. And so I think it's important to not just take what people are saying at face value, but to interrogate it through legitimate media sources. And so I think here, legacy mainstream media are actually really important here, because they have editorial processes. And you'll see sort of like what they said that was true and what they said that kind of, you know, leaves a little bit more to be desired.
Thanks for that call. We're recapping last night's vice presidential debate with Andra Gillespie, associate professor of political science at Emory University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think about last night's debate? Did it matter to you one way or another in making up your own mind? Do you want to see more presidential debates? It's kind of up in the air right now. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about last night's vice presidential debate. Andra Gillespie is with us, associate professor of political science and director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute at Emory University. You can join in still with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Go back to your calls now. Bree is with us in Waukesha. Bree, hello.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Bree?
I had watched, PBS had been, is my go-to choice for watching these debates. And they had a panel of likely voters that came on after for a little bit of analysis. And it listening to a lot of them speak, it kind of just reminded me, it feels like we're living in two different realities. Some of the panelists who said that they were Trump supporters had said, you know, that they thought it was really fair. They thought that Biden was, you know, his aggressiveness was perfectly fine, or that he wasn't getting enough time, actually. And it just shocks me. It just seems like we're living in two different sets of how we're watching this. And I don't know if that's because of political bias or if it's just generally how we're seeing the world completely differently.
Bree,
but it really did kind of disturb me.
Bree, thanks a lot for the call. Andra, are we living in kind of two separate political realities?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, a lot of it has to do with political polarization and then also how we process information. So, you know, we're living in extremely polarized times. And that polarization is driven by a lot of things. One, parties that used to be big tents that used to have their own ideological diversity, so they'd have conservatives and liberals kind of in the same spaces in both parties. That's no longer really the case. The liberals have flocked to the Democratic Party and conservatives have flocked to the Republican Party. This is largely true for whites. It's less true for people of color for reasons having to do with race and perceptions of racism and sort of the stances on race that the parties have taken. But what that means is that people don't interact with each other and they don't really have – there isn't a middle, so there aren't people to really be a bridge to the other side. The other thing that's happening is this thing that my colleague Alan Abramo has called negative partisanship. So sometimes you define your own partisanship by knowing that don't agree with the other side. So I am this because I am not that. And that manifests itself in a lot of ways. And one of the ways that it happens is in survey questions, we ask whether or not people think that folks in the opposing party are just, you know, well-intentioned people whose ideas differ from mine or people whose ideas are dangerous. And we've othered our partisan opponents in ways that I think are actually really troubling and really damaging. And that also increases the odds of one-upsmanship. So you can't concede that the other side might have a point or might be right on a particular issue, right, if the consequences and the stakes are so high that, like, power or, you know, something along those lines. So I think that, you know, I think I appreciate that you care about this. So I think that you and others who are like-minded are going to have to model better behavior of learning to get to know deeply people whose views are opposing to yours and who are willing to respect other ideas, and people who are willing to look at facts objectively and not just cherry pick information that's going to confirm what they already believe. You know, unfortunately, like from television, we can see that when people encounter discordant facts, they tend to double down on what they already believe. They don't necessarily see that as an opportunity for reflection and perhaps to be persuaded.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Tony now in Ironwood, Michigan. Tony, hi.
Well, hi. You know, I said a couple of weeks ago, it occurred to me that it would be a miracle if either of these men won the presidency. I think of them as both so badly flawed. You know, Trump, for all his horrible tweets, I think what he's done is not necessarily so bad, what he actually does, but what he says is horrible. And Biden, I don't know how to size him up. He feels his son Hunter did nothing wrong. I would say he possibly did nothing illegal, okay? But this whole idea of politicians having a right to cash in, and you know, you see so many people get into politics and they end up being quite wealthy. And so I consider neither one of them to be worthy of president, to tell you
Tony,
the truth.
Thanks a lot for the call. Now, that takes me back to 2016, Andra, when there was a substantial constituency that really didn't like either of the candidates. Do you feel like that's as big a group in the United States this time around?
So if we look at favorability ratings, and Joe Biden's favorability certainly, you know, takes a hit over the course of the campaign as a result of negative campaigning. But Joe Biden isn't in the same type of position as being disliked in the same way that Hillary Clinton was. Why Hillary Clinton was so disliked is something that a lot of people are going to speculate on, particularly in thinking about the role of gender and perhaps fomenting that. So Joe Biden is in a different position. There are people who fundamentally disagree with him, right? They don't agree with his policies. They don't agree with his record of service. There are people who, you know, would be predisposed to not support him because they don't share his partisan convictions or they don't share his views on certain key issues. And I think that that's to be expected. I think what voters are going to have to, you know, reckon with, and it's a decision that each person is going to have to make, is what are their values, how well they think the incumbent administration has performed, and who are they going to be comfortable casting a ballot with? Who, under whose administration are you going to want to live under for the next 4 years? So, you know, I think each person has to make their decision, and we hope to give them to give them enough information so that they can make informed choices.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Andra Gillespie from Emory University, looking at last night's debate. Let's go back to our callers now. Emily with us in Green Bay. Emily, hello.
Hello. Yes, I would just like to say that I think Senator Harris is very much qualified for the office of vice president. She was the attorney general for the state of California. She was a prosecutor. She's now a senator, and she's on several committees through the Senate. I think she's more qualified than Donald Trump was.
Emily, thanks a lot for the call. That was maybe a plus and a minus for candidate Donald Trump, his lack of government experience. Andra, how do you think the qualification issue stacks up for voters?
I think that some of this is affect and sort of partisanship and, you know, other personal proclivities. I also think that, you know, a lot of the discussion that we have, and I think we're going to have a national reckoning about this going forward, is what is our relationship with expertise and with elites. So sometimes there are people who feel that, you know, elites, you know, people who are Beltway insiders, cultural elite college professors like me, you know, tend to condescend to regular folks. And so I think Donald Trump, in part, was able to capitalize on that frustration. But I think we have to have a conversation about what expertise looks like in different contexts and who we should trust to be able to make decisions and who we should entrust certain decision-making capacities too. You know, I will say this, you know, somebody who has a PhD, my PhD is all well and good, but if I think that I can learn to rewire, like, my house by watching some videos, I hope that an electrician, like, laughs in my face and calls me, right, because I'm probably just setting my house on fire. And so there is expertise in lots of different places, and we should take advantage of it. I think we should understand that sometimes people who are professional bureaucrats or people who are professional politicians have gained some skills along the way. And that's hard to do when you're in a democracy where everybody does have a say and we want to honor that. But I think it's also important to sort of, you know, understand that there are people who have spent their lives and their careers studying these issues and knowing the ins and outs of details. And, you know, perhaps they would deserve the same type of deference that I would give to my electrician or to my mechanic who can fix my car in ways that I can't.
I want to take just our last minute or so for a look at possible future presidential debates. Supposed to be two more. Now, the debate commission says, hold on, the president has a contagious disease. We're going to make the next one an online, a virtual debate. Now, the president says, nope, I'm out. This story has been changing through the day. What does it mean if we don't have one or both of those debates now, Andra?
Well, sort of in perspective, people tend to learn more from the first debate than they do from the later debates. And debates are useful for people who don't have a whole lot of information, who haven't been following the contest. This is their introduction. And so if we think about that as the first impression for some candidates who were just, for some voters who were just turning into the 2019 cycle or 2020 cycle, we got what we got, right? And so President Trump is taking a risk by kind of making that at least the sort of closing argument for now, right? He wants to do it with rallies, and we'll see whether or not people pay attention there. I think there's also the issue of what does it mean that a president who is presumably contagious refuses to, like, you know, be willing to undertake sort of having a virtual debate where he can't be in the same room with other people, right? The things that we've been talking about over the last couple of days about some of the decisions that he made, from whether it was the drive around Walter Reed or taking off his mask when he got back to the White House, right? It's sending really important optics about sort of the president's empathy and about his judgment at this particular time.
Andra, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute at Emory University. She joined us today to talk about last night's vice presidential debate.